I don't even know how I have 40 followers on Twitter, to be honest with you.
We're talking sports.
I got two.
Oh, you have two now.
With a couple of guys you've never even heard of.
I don't really understand it. It's crazy.
It's Moving the Goalposts. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, review, and tell a friend. Moving the Goalposts wherever you listen.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Moving the Goalposts. I'm your host, Nick Mara, joined by my co-host, Mike Masala. Mike, how are you now?
I'm doing well, brother. How are you?
Not so bad. We're also joined by producer extraordinaire, Mian. What's up?
How about them Celts?
Celtics playing well. Celtics playing very well. Mm-hmm. I think a week ago we said Celtics in like six, Celtics in five.
Yeah, that's changed.
We were feeling good about them. Yeah, I would definitely say that six games at this point would be shocking. They're up 3-0. Game four is tonight. And I think the chances of them sweeping are more likely to occur than them winning in five, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I'm pretty much right there as well. They've dominated both sides of the floor. There have been stretches where they haven't looked as great. Like, obviously, game one, you're allowing Kyrie to do whatever Kyrie wanted. And then in this past game, it was a closer game in game three than it really felt. The whole time, I never really felt like it was in doubt. Like, there were points where the game was two-point lead, tied, four-point lead. Like, I always thought the Celtics were going to come out on top in that game because it didn't feel like Kevin Durant was doing Kevin Durant things. And that's kind of been the case this whole series. And I don't know if you credit Jason Tatum with that, Ime Udoka with that, discredit Kevin Durant with that. Just what they've done in as a whole in this series has been very impressive.
Yeah, I mean, well, they've taken Durant like out of the picture. And I don't know if it's more players than Ime, because obviously Ime knows these guys. He was, you know, an assistant coach with Brooklyn last year. So he does know probably what is going to make Durant, you know, it's going to tick him off and not play up to his game, because he looks uncomfortable. And honestly, he's not playing that. He's not playing great basketball at all. His ball handling looks like crap. And it's just, they're making him very uncomfortable, pushing him around. Their defense all around as a team has been pretty like impressive, incredible, really. I didn't really think I was going to go defensively, especially with Kyrie. I mean, I know Kyrie is still a pretty big factor in these games, but their defense is probably the most surprising thing, especially when it comes to Durant.
They're a fun defense to watch. I think it's kind of rare that you would say that in the NBA, that a team is fun to watch defensively, but they're so active. They're constantly trying to get the ball. They're helping out. They're switching. They're doing everything it takes to slow down Brooklyn's attack, and they've done a tremendous job of that so far. You know, you guys mentioned that Durant has not been himself, and whether that has to be Udoka's sort of his entire defensive scheme as a team, or if it's been direct matchup one-on-one, whoever's been guarding Durant. I think that Durant is hurt. I don't know if he's injured, but I definitely think that he's hurt. This guy has played more basketball, I think, over the last 40 days than anybody else in the league. Him and Kyrie Irving, I saw a tweet. I don't have it up in front of me, and I don't remember exactly what it was, but I saw that him and Kyrie Irving rank one and two among the most minutes played over the course of a certain amount of time. And it's catching up to them. This is a team that had to compete very, very hard down the stretch just to make the play-in game. And you have to wonder if maybe balling out during the stretch run in the regular season has affected them for the playoffs, where they're totally gassed.
All right. And you're also seeing Kyrie say things like, oh, we've only had a certain amount of time to gel as the team. Dude, that's kind of on you, my guy. If you were in the building playing every game instead of just the away games, like, you would be fine, but you weren't.
So where do we rank that among the, like, point the finger at Kyrie Irving and say this is another example of how he kind of tears apart teams from the inside out?
I mean, yes, but it's kind of, and I'm not advocating for the reason why Kyrie didn't play in New York, but I guess you could say that was an unforeseen circumstance to a point. I mean, you know, whether believing whether he wants to, you know, be vaccinated or not, and then waiting for, you know, New York to lift that mandate. But it's, I see where you're going with it. It's kind of like I don't know how to describe it. You know what I'm saying, though?
It's kind of I know exactly what you're saying, because it's him making a selfless decision for a selfish reason, or vice versa. And like, I don't know exactly which one it is, but it's him putting himself before and what he believes before the team. And, you know, a lot of people could say that's always going to be more important, what you believe, if you really.
And it's happening in every league. There are players like this in every league.
Yeah. And,
you know, some obviously Kyrie is probably ranked above, you know, some, you know, other players, but.
Tyler Bertuzzi was the only player in the NHL not to get vaccinated, but he didn't have to worry about not being able to play in certain places other than Canada. Actually, he couldn't play in Canada this year, but the rule itself was kind of stupid. Like, he could towards the end of it, he could literally go there and watch and sit courtside as a fan, but he couldn't play in the game.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous, but it seems like it's something that we're not going to have to talk about moving on, at least. But you have to wonder, like, if Kyrie Irving is just a little bit more on the ball and with the program and more of a team player, you know, does this Brooklyn team finish with the seventh seed, and are they down 3-0 to Boston?
No, you probably are a little bit higher in the standing. The tough part there is the whole season they had a bunch of different issues. They had James Harden, who has been, I wouldn't say a cancer, but not the best teammate, not the best guy to have around. Kevin Durant was injured for part of the season. Kyrie had his thing. So it was a mix of all these things. I don't think they finished like a top three seed, but I'm sure they finished a little bit higher than where they ended up. We talked about it before this series started, and back when Robert Williams, the injury was announced during our recording, like, playing together means something, having that familiarity and with those lineups, with those roles, how these guys are going to play. Now for the Celtics, it hasn't looked like it's meant that much. So I guess that's a little bit of a shot at my own take right now, but it does mean something there. So I guess it would be a little bit better to have them.
I actually think the Celtics do play as a team. Like, that has shown, the fact that they've been with each other and grown with each other, whether you want to say it's been over the course of one season or if you want to say it's been over the course of multiple seasons.
That's what I was going to ask you guys. Who's playing like the more complete team right now?
It's absolutely Boston, isn't it?
Yeah, it's because by default, I mean, so they were the Nets were the preseason favorite in the conference, right?
Yeah.
I don't think the Nets stink. I don't think they suck. Like, if it were a totally, for the sake of argument, say COVID never happened. Like, let's just put it that way. Kyrie plays the entire season. Yeah, they're probably they're definitely within the top five, probably in the top three, finishing, you know, seeded wise. Celtics, I don't, like, let's say they finish the same. So it's tough to say that the Nets suck. They don't. You know, Kyrie made his decision, so that's why they're not gelling as a team. But I also think they're quitters.
Right.
Especially Durant. Like,
right.
And so I don't want to jinx it and say, you know, it's going to be a sweep. Like, you know, Celtics in four, that's it. Because I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, Brooklyn did win tonight. Nothing would shock me. I don't think it's going to go right back to seven. But I don't know. I'm not going to rule out Durant, but he has that within him. So they could probably just say, F it. That's why Simmons isn't going to play tonight. They're not going to go all out to push this to seven and try to win the series.
Well, so in there, there's an interesting, if I was listening to the radio properly, I guess Scott Foster is on the game tonight, and he's like the most corrupt ref in the league. So if anybody is going to push it, if anybody's going to push it to a game five, it would be, you know, the NBA official. And doesn't it kind of make for a better storyline in the league that Kyrie has to go back to Boston for at least one more game?
Mm-hmm.
What scares the hell out of me is that they do end up winning tonight, and then they come back to Boston and some freaky thing happens where Kyrie Irving goes off again and they steal that game. Now all of a sudden it's 3-2 and you're back in Brooklyn and you do have yourself a series.
I mean, I think dangerous. The NBA is the most rigged league, so I wouldn't be surprised.
They definitely have that history. But that was the whole conversation before the series started, was the Celtics may not have been the more talented team, but they were the more complete team. And like depth was a huge conversation that once, I mean, look what happened with Brooklyn in this series. Like, you're playing again, your same basically seven guys, kind of like the Celtics are. And then like Blake Griffin comes in and the whole crowd goes wild because there's no depth pieces who are doing all that much. Like Goran Dragic has had a surprisingly good series, but like the Celtics, they're getting the defensive effort out of Grant Williams every time he goes on the floor. Peyton Pritchard is like the best player on the court every time he touches the parquet.
I was watching game three with my father. He's not a huge basketball fan, but he said when Blake Griffin came out onto the court and after like 2 or 3 minutes of him playing, he was like, what did they pull him off the bench for the sun? My God, he's so red. He looks like he's about to explode.
The broadcast was going crazy about him. They were like, look at the effort that Blake's putting in tonight. It's really a heroic performance.
And I did think that he played pretty well. He provided a little bit of a spark off the bench. He provided something that the Nets sorely needed, which was a spark off the bench. Just someone who was going to give him a little bit extra.
By the way, when's the last time you guys remember? Maybe it's just because I don't watch Brooklyn every single game. When's the last time Blake Griffin even played a basketball game? Is it just me or like, I don't
maybe
know.
Maybe February, March, if that.
Okay.
Are we still in April?
So I'm not crazy.
No, you're not.
Okay. Okay.
No, if you look at the Nets roster like this, I was thinking this the other day. Put this team together in 2015. LaMarcus Aldridge, Seth Curry, Goran Dragic, Andre Drummond, Kevin Durant, Blake Griffin, Kyrie Irving, Joe Harris, Patty Mills, Ben Simmons. Like, that team is ridiculous seven years ago.
Right. If you're healthy and not super old, that's a decent team. But the problem is that they haven't been, and the Celtics have gotten the most out of their bench. So
hell, throw Steve Nash into that. If 7 years ago, Steve Nash probably would have been able to help the team as well. And that's, I mean, not to cut you off, Mike, but Nash has been just totally exposed in this series as well.
Him kind of being like, they're playing the most minutes in basketball right now. It's like, dude, you control that. You've been the one who's let them ramp up to the playoffs and to the play-in game. And I know you needed to get there, but there wasn't really much doubt that you'd be in the playoff game. So, and that's the way you've played the whole season with one guy or two guys. They would have been fine there. And he is being, I wouldn't call for his firing right now, but I think that's what a lot of people are going to say after this series.
What's he being exposed for though? Like, even before the season, Kyrie was like, well, we don't really have a coach. That's not a coached team. That's a team that has the mentality that they don't really need a coach. With both Durant and Kyrie, I think they both have that within them. They thought that at the beginning of the season.
Did Nash have any experience, any coaching experience, assistant coaching experience, or anything before he got the Brooklyn job, or was it basically like he played in the NBA, retired, went away for a couple of years, and then all of a sudden his name popped up and he got the job?
I thought he might have coached a little bit, but apparently not.
This whole series, he's been as useful as that door behind me.
I think that's the case
the entire season.
That door behind you has probably been more useful than Steve Nash has. I mean, I'm not a big basketball guy in terms of like the X's and O's, but even I could figure out after game one and halfway through game two, they're swarming Kevin Durant. They're putting two guys, three guys on Kevin Durant. Wait a minute. That means somebody else is open. Mm-hmm. Why don't you just give them the ball? Like, I don't know how well Kevin Durant can play off the ball. But that's what he needs to do. He needs to come off screens. You need to create space for him because he's unable to do it himself, which is very rare that he's unable to do it himself. And he's missed a lot of shots that I think he probably should have made, especially in game two. And that could be because of, like I said, it seems like he's just dealing with something a little bit more physical than mental.
Yeah, he seems gassed. He seems extremely tired. It's almost like a game of 2K when you like run into your opponent and you lose half your stamina right away. Like, that's what it feels like every time he goes down the court.
Apt. Mm-hmm. Very, very good comparison. Where would the Nets be if Ben Simmons wasn't such a pussy? I mean, there's no other way of putting it.
Yikes. It's not a great look. Not a great look to come out saying, oh, yeah, I've been fine. And then after you're facing elimination, oh, my back hurts again. Sorry, guys. If they brought him into the series, though, I don't think it would have been better. Again, like talking about the communication, the familiarity with guys on the guy hasn't played basketball all year. It's not like he's going to come out. Like, imagine Ben Simmons came out and he was just draining threes. Like, completely different player.
Right. Well, we saw Blake Griffin expend 10 minutes of energy, almost had a heart attack. They had to bring out a defibrillator. What would Ben Simmons have looked like?
Right. Instead of looking like Shaggy in an episode of Scooby-Doo, like on the sideline, like he's out there playing.
Ridiculous.
The good thing is his defense is that good. Like, he is an all NBA level defender, but that's it. That's all he'd provide. And they're not consistent enough offensively to bring in a guy who doesn't bring you anything.
But even defensively, if this is the type of team that needs to defend as a team and they can't just lock up one guy and say, all right, we're going to go man to man, which, but by the way, I'm again, talk about the X's and O's of basketball. When they were saying during the halftime show that on game three, they're like, how do you come out after losing the first two games of the series, your first game home, and you come out in a zone? A zone is what you do for like 5 minutes just to change it up. And I'm like, isn't a zone defense like basically what the Celtics have been playing though?
Yeah, they've definitely been playing a weird mixture of stuff. But we saw the Heat beat the Celtics in a zone a couple years ago, and
right.
they weren't able to handle it.
Right.
So I wasn't totally against that move. But like once you see, you do have to adapt. Like once you see a team attacking your zone and being able to find the creases and score. I don't know. This whole series has been kind of weird. We all expected it to go like six. I think we all said six games, and that's just it. It's been the complete opposite of what I thought. Like it's been a drubbing, if you will.
I mean, I was not afraid of Brooklyn. I think I may have even said in one episode, like, give me the Nets, give me this, like, we're in the playoffs. This is the first round. This is the game that we're going to have to play. Wake us up. And then all of a sudden it's like, boom, we're ready to go. And you roll on your way to a finals appearance to then lose probably to Golden State.
Well, then that's the real question is, do we look ahead? Do we dare look past the Nets and see what's lying ahead of us? And it's Milwaukee.
I mean,
with no Chris Middleton likely, but
by the time this comes out and then we would have a chance to record the series, the second round probably will just be starting. But yeah, I think it's safe to say we can look ahead.
I hope so.
By the way, I can't tell if Mian is frozen or not.
No, I'm sorry. I was looking at my...
he was intently looking in the same position for like the last 5 minutes.
It really was. It really was.
I mean, with my internet connection, it would happen. So, all right. That's funny.
but no, I think that the series going into it, I thought Boston definitely had a chance, and I was embracing the idea of Brooklyn, you know, being the first round opponent. Did I think that it was going to go the way that it has? No, I didn't. But I also didn't expect Kevin Durant to be a pumpkin in the first three games.
Credit to the defense. So I do have a question for you guys, though. Does this spill the end in Brooklyn? Do you think like it's going to begin to fizzle out, or do you think they give it one more year, say like Simmons, you know, comes back and all that stuff? Like, what do you guys think?
I think they definitely get rid of Steve Nash.
And replace him with someone else just to stand there and look pretty.
But that's the thing, is you need an actual coach. You need somebody who's going to say to the players that are out there, hey, what we're doing isn't working. Let's do something different. Because I agree, basketball is the type of game where you can kind of roll the balls out and let the superstars be the superstars. And it's very much just the best player is going to win the game. But this is a situation where your best player is being taken out of the game. You have to adjust. And the player's not going to be able to adjust because they're just going to keep doing what they think they need to do.
I'd agree with you if Kevin and Kyrie were guys that would take coaching. I just don't think that that's they're that group.
Yeah,
I don't know who you'd bring in. Like who is a coach that these guys would listen to? And maybe you don't need that. Maybe you need a guy that they just like, because it didn't seem like the way it started that they were big fans of Steve Nash. But I would also think that you would have to be big fans of Steve Nash if he was getting the job. Like, I feel like they were probably pretty pretty heavy in that decision making process.
If they brought in someone like J.R. Smith or something like that,
he's too busy playing D1 golf.
Oh, is it Division 1? That he's playing?
I think so.
Damn. What an athlete.
He's pretty good.
Incredible.
Real quick question.
Yeah.
There are 2 open head coaching gigs with like 2 of the best superstars in the NBA in LA and Brooklyn. And we have a head coach who's playing GM right now.
Thoughts? No way. Absolutely not. He said that on, was it Toucher and Rich? He was like, no, like I walk into my closet and everything's green. Like, I'm a Celtic. Like, if I go to the Lakers, it's like, I would not like myself. This was essentially what he was saying.
I mean, I'm just saying it's interesting. It's an interesting opportunity of your head coach prospects, quote unquote. And usually this is a sport where you know some of them, but you don't have like a huge sample size. Like in the NFL, you normally have all the offensive coordinators, defensive coordinators. You know those guys. The NBA, you know a few.
You know what? It was you who tweeted the other day about the guy that was, James Borrega.
Yep, never heard that name in my life.
Yep.
He's been the head coach there for like 4 seasons. I've never once heard that name.
Yeah, because again, like you think it's Charlotte. What do you think of?
Michael Jordan.
Like, you think that's the person that's running that franchise, that organization, but they've also been a disaster for the majority of their existence.
Right.
I don't think that Brooklyn is in a position that's really that fixable. Like, Andrew, I think that's a good point that you bring up does this spell the end of the Nets era? You know, and looking back, I think a year ago, if you had asked me, how does the Danny Ainge, Paul Pierce, Kevin Garnett trade for, all the picks look? I'd say I'd still do it. Obviously, I'd still do it because you have 2 foundational pieces, but you would like to be further or closer to a championship than further away from the team that you made that deal with, that you essentially bankrupted that franchise for a decade.
And even like, it's not like Brooklyn Nets fans, whoever they are, they're not going to care. They're not going to care. They don't care that they're there in the first place. New York is Knicks. It's all Knicks. Even with how terrible the Knicks have been for as long as anybody can remember.
You know what?
It just comes up Knicks.
Mary J. Blige might be an actual Nets fan, or at least a Kevin Durant.
I think her and Jay-Z, because Jay-Z built them a friggin' stadium in Brooklyn. But granted, it was back in 2017 and Jeremy Lin was a friggin' Brooklyn Net. I swear to God, like 70% of the stadium, which was all black and white in Brooklyn Nets gear, was not cheering for the Brooklyn Nets. That's pretty sure it was Fan Appreciation Day. It was the last game of the regular season. Everything in the pro shop was 50% off. And I'm pretty sure that's the number one reason that people were there. I was cheering for the Nets, and I'm not even a Nets fan. It was a school trip. The tickets were cheap. I went. A couple buddies went too. I was cheering for the home team, and they won. They came back and they beat the Bulls, in the last couple of seconds. It was a fun game to watch, but weird fan base. Weird.
How much do you guys think tickets are right now for game 4 tonight?
In Brooklyn?
Yeah.
Cheap. I would probably say
they're probably still pretty expensive. Just because I think it's like a, I don't know, it feels like a club atmosphere there, not even like a game.
Damn. $190 on StubHub to get in.
I don't know if that's a lot. Is that a lot?
I would say that's a lot for a first round playoff series.
I think that's less than the TD Garden, though.
I think it is definitely less to get in, because I was looking at TD Garden prices on StubHub and it was like $225, $220 just to get in.
I think the cheapest tickets I saw for the Celtics was on game one was Easter. And I think just because it was the holiday and they were trying to get people to go, which I mean, it was still a packed house, but I vividly remember them being cheaper on Easter Sunday.
And here we go. And another one of those
right up
my sister's boyfriend's cousin. Actually, ironically, it is my sister's boyfriend's cousin has season tickets to the Celtics. I know, right? It was like, wait a minute.
My sister's brother's cousin. Wait, it is my sister's brother's. Oh, okay.
So he has season tickets to the Celtics. I've been trying to angle him to be like, yeah, I can't make it to a game. Do you want him? Yeah, I'll take him. So, that was a little aside.
I mean, we can get into a whole thing on ticket prices. I was looking up when the Red Sox were playing in Detroit just to see what the prices were like out there.
Hold on. We'll do an over. We'll do prices right over under between me and I. Well, I guess if one of us says $1, that's kind of a pussy move. I'll say get in. Or yep. Is this standing room or like I have a seat?
This is a seat opening day weekend, not opening day.
$11.
Man.
For the Sox in Detroit, you said?
Yep.
Well, we can't both pick the over. Yeah, we could both pick the over, right? It's not really a competition.
You could if you were lower than him.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I would say over 15.
It was $7 to get in.
Holy, so we both lost.
Crap. It was way off.
$7 to get in opening day. And they were still only like 7,000 people at each game. I was looking.
There was, I think, 3,400 people at an Oakland Athletics game. And that was like big news, which low attendance now to me doesn't mean as much because we went through seasons where there were no fans in the stands. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like, yeah, whatever. It's not as weird as that game between the Orioles and the White Sox like a decade ago.
Yeah.
After one of like the protests where there was nobody in the stadium, they wouldn't let anybody in. That was kind of creepy.
That was one of the craziest games. Also, this tweet's going viral from Ben Simmons from 2020 that says, watching my team get swept hurt, and I don't even ever want to feel that way again.
Wow. Oh, I had a tweet last night that irritated some people.
What'd you say? Oh, is it what I think it is about a certain Bruins game that happened last night?
About the game. It was just like, all right, so this is how I'm going to say it, because it does come off as very insensitive. And as the three of us embark on, you know, the hopeful media careers that we have, going against the grain may sometimes blow up in our face. I think this is probably one of those examples where if I was a little bit more well known, I probably would have deleted it and may in the future, just depending on how I feel about it. But one of the major issues I have with the Montreal organization is that they live on the past. And I know you are honoring one of your franchise's greatest players, the life of their player. However, it's kind of what I'm saying. It's one thing to be like, okay, we're, you know, remembering someone who played in the franchise, we're going to, you know, do a nice little video tribute. It's another thing entirely to have a 10-minute standing ovation and be chanting the guy's name throughout the game. It's one night and it's a night for them to tribute him. So maybe it was obviously in poor taste that I said what I said, which is basically like, here's your reminder while they're serenading Guy Lafleur that they haven't won a championship since 1993, which isn't even really a horrible thing to say. It's just the truth. But it's 27 rings, right? And we saw that over the weekend with the Yankees and the Guardians, the Indians. So
a lot of interesting fan bases going on right now.
Yeah. So yeah, I was just gonna say, in the future, if someone is being recognized days after they've died, I will refrain from slandering or I don't even know what word to use. I don't know.
I would have just said that it was probably a little too much on that tweet.
It's not the right time. Too soon. You know what happened was
not too before, soon. Just not never should have happened.
The
just
day
get
before,
ahead of the ball and delete it now.
I was maybe I will. I was watching Gilbert Gottfried highlights the day before, and I guess he did like a 9/11 joke very soon after 9/11. Where he was saying like, I'm sorry, I would have been here sooner, except I had to pick a plane from California. It would have been a one way, but they said we have to stop at the Empire State Building first.
That's a actually pretty solid Gilbert Gottfried impression. Better than I expected it to be.
I don't think Gilbert Gottfried is very difficult to impersonate. He's very whiny.
Apparently, that's not even his real voice, though.
No?
No.
Yeah, I think I saw that, too.
Yeah, it was something on Stern where, like, it's not. Yeah. I'm gonna be asking Nick to do an impression later when I give you guys my quick Batman review during our final blow.
Oh, boy.
Perfect. My take on that, on your tweet. See, my thing is, if you're over 60, I don't feel too bad. Like,
Mike, you can't say that.
Like, I'm just saying, I looked up how old he was. He was 70. That's a long life, man.
He had cancer. Well, no, it's not. I guess it's not. Like, 62, and he had cancer, which I didn't make fun of how he died. I didn't even really make fun of him. I didn't make fun of anybody. I made fun of the franchise.
It's still not good timing, though.
I was simply pointing out that this once proud franchise that considered themselves to be the patriarchs of the NHL hasn't won a fucking thing in 3 decades. I will delete it. I will delete it.
You shouldn't delete it. I disagree.
I will screenshot it, hold it in my photos, and delete it so that it still exists, but not really.
I can't wait for you to tweet out, Guy Lafleur went down just like the chances of the Canadians winning another cup this year. Like I'm waiting for it.
Well, and as I was watching the game, I'm waiting to see if they end up blowing it because they had like a 4-1 lead going into like the third period or something. Montreal scores 2 goals. They make it a 1-goal game. And I'm like, they're going to lose this game. And I'm going to feel like Guy Lafleur dead.
There's a reason why I'm not saying anything.
Andrew's gonna cut out this whole portion.
No, I'll leave it in, but there's a reason. I won't have to cut anything out that I've said because I'm not saying anything.
Let us go down with the ship.
You know, the funny thing too was I was thinking about quote tweeting myself and saying, like, at least I tweeted this while wearing a tuxedo, so don't call me not unclassy. Mike, I want all of your extensive draft knowledge right now because we've got T-minus 72 hours, 24,
48, 72. I was told there'd be no math.
Yeah, we got for the NFL draft. And obviously, you know everything for the Dolphins. And the Patriots need everything. So let's find out what's going to be available. Do the Dolphins have a first round pick this year?
The Dolphins don't have a first nor a second round pick this year. So I will be very bored until Friday. Oh. Friday and Saturday will be very fun. It seems like this is the worst draft since 2013, which is like the worst draft ever. Not great. A lot of that is because of the quarterbacks. There's really nothing too exciting there. It's all potential, like, and I know every draft is kind of like that, but there's no like prospect you're really excited about this year for the quarterback position. Luckily, I think for this year, the Patriots are pretty much set on that. I don't think they'll be diving into a top tier quarterback, maybe a potential at the end of the draft. If they're looking for a potential Jarrett Stidham replacement, eventual Brian Hoyer replacement guy. But you do have a lot of talent in different places. I just don't know if it's the best. So like we talked about, the Patriots need a little bit of everything in the first round where they're at. I think they have a pretty good chance to grab any of the wide receivers that are going to be there. I think they'll probably still be two or three first round guys when they come up. You have a chance at cornerback, maybe a guy like Trent McDuffie, Derek Stingley, who's been talked about sliding because of his foot injury.
If he slides to 21 and the Patriots don't draft him, because that possibility hasn't crossed my mind.
I saw one or two mock drafts that had him sliding down to the Patriots selection. They did grab him both times. And obviously that's everybody's doing mock drafts, so it doesn't really mean anything. But it's interesting that some people are putting McDuffie ahead of him from Washington. The Patriots, they do need everything to me. I think if you were going into this first round and you can grab a tackle, a wide receiver, a cornerback, a linebacker, any of those positions make a lot of sense for this team right now. And I think you'll have a chance to grab a solid contributor at any of those positions.
So I have a question. Obviously, with the Dolphins not having a pick until the third round, I would imagine that the research you've done has probably been more about the depth of the draft. When you say that this is probably the weakest one that we've had in almost a decade, are you referring to like the top end, high end talent, or are you saying like from the top of the draft to the bottom of the draft, the talent is very diluted? Basically, what I'm asking you is, do we at least have deeper talent in the middle to end of the draft?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the position. I think wide receiver, you're going to have guys in like the third, fourth, fifth rounds who are going to be contributors. And then same thing with cornerback. Those seem to be kind of the deeper positions. You get a little bit with linebackers sliding back from the first and second round, like N'Kobe Dean. If you had told me last year that he's going to be a second round pick, I would have gone crazy because that guy looked incredible at points last season. I think it's more of the top end, just not that great, but overall the group's not the best.
Is Nick frozen?
No, I'm not. I was just pulling this up.
Oh.
What is this Kuiper? I don't know whose this is. I'm on ESPN and they have a best available. These are the names that they have listed 1 through 10. I will tell you if I've heard of them before. Aiden Hutchinson. Yes. Aiden Hutchinson will probably be a good player. I think that he's the consensus number one, depending on what Jacksonville wants to do, whether they want to go defense or offense. Ikem Ekwonu. I think I've heard of him. Evan Neal. I've maybe heard of, kind of. Kyle Hamilton. Ahmad Garner. Garrett Wilson. Garrett Wilson. Is Garrett Wilson the best receiver from Ohio State?
That's what it's kind of up in the air. People think that his like athleticism has a possibility of making him the better option, but it's kind of, you can kind of take either of those guys.
Kayvon Thibodeau from Oregon, Trayvon Walker, Drake London, Jermaine Johnson, the second, Derek Stingley. They have him at 11. I think he's going to go top 10. A lot of the names that I've been hearing linked to the Patriots that the Patriots have been interested in, it doesn't seem like they're going to really be top 10 type talents. So I don't know what can we expect New England to do?
I do think that they're not going to go after a wide receiver in this first round, even though I think they probably should. If there's one of those top three cornerbacks out there for them, I think that's the direction they should go. The Patriots, a lot of people are going to look at their history of drafting cornerbacks, and it hasn't been pretty. You have your Duke Dawsons, you have your Jason McCourty was a successful one, but he moved to safety and that's where he became the most successful. You have a bunch of different guys who have not worked out in New England drafting in that position. So, but that's the position I think they need the most. Like I think cornerback, them losing JC Jackson and replacing him with Malcolm Butler, who hasn't played in a year, and Terrence Mitchell, who bounced around to like two or three teams in the last two seasons. They need to do something there, or this defense could end up looking really bad. McDuffie has been the guy who I've seen the most falling down that way, so I think he would be the most likely option for them. But I also wouldn't be surprised if they end up trading back. That just seems like the Belichick thing to do. Trade back, a guy that you like a little bit more, pick up some more draft value. That seems like the thing to do. Would you guys be against drafting Jameson Williams right now, knowing that he's probably going to miss the first couple months of the season?
I'm so into the idea of drafting either immediate help or guys that are going to stick around for a long time, because you need talent. You need young talent that you can build around. Either one of those, whether it's going to be a guy who you can plug and play and get whatever you need out of him, or someone that they might need to wait a little bit on, as long as they're a player. That's all I need from them.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, I'm thinking that Jameson Williams right now, you're probably not gonna get anything out of him in his rookie season, because we've seen how it's tough for receivers to pick up this system. So even if he comes in and starts getting on the field in November, you're probably not going to expect anything out of him his rookie season. But they're at the place where next season, I don't believe they have Kendrick Bourne or Nelson Agholor on the roster going forward. And Jakobi Meyers is also a free agent, and N'Keal Harry. So they don't really have anything past this year.
Well, fifth-year option, right, on N'Keal Harry?
There's the possibility of the fifth-year option. Yeah,
that's He's not going to be on the roster.
I don't think he's going to be on the roster this season. I would be willing to take that risk of a guy. The team right now is already not set up to win this year. So if you can, like you said, grab that talent and build towards something, build for the next 4 years, I would be interested in that option, especially where the ACL, everybody talks about it. It's like, it's not the same injury that it was 10, 15 years ago. The guys come back quickly and they come back to the form that they were before. It's not like a career ending injury. And we're kind of seeing that with Achilles now too. And maybe we'll start to see that with Lisfranc injuries that Derek Stingley had. It's kind of all over the place.
Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty confident, because our last two drafts have been trending in the right direction. Duggar, I thought that was a hit. Last year's draft, I thought was great with Mac Jones, and with Christian Barmore was a hit. Stevenson.
They did hit on a lot of guys.
Yeah. But their trade, the last 2 years, it's trending in the right direction. So is wide receiver a need? Yes. Is it the biggest need? No. I'd be fine with getting a lineman in the first round. I'd be fine with them going after, you know, I'd want them to go after a linebacker. They need to get faster at linebacker, especially with the speed and the talent that's not just in their division now, but is in the entire AFC. In the entire AFC, they need to get a lot faster, especially at the linebacker position. Corner, they've been, Belichick has had that stroke of luck of getting rid of who, you know, the potential next guy, and then finding the next guy after that. You know, it's Malcolm and then JC Jackson. Those, you know, that's like the latest example. So I'm confident that they could find a late round corner and just develop him and build him up. But I'd be fine with them going just after him. If they picked a linebacker or a lineman, for an example, in the first round, then they probably get Metchie in the second round, who they've already met with. I think, did they meet with Chris Olave?
I believe they did.
I think they did, right?
They probably met with everybody. This is another great question for you guys. What the hell is a top 30 pick? What does that mean?
So you can only bring like 30 guys into your building.
How are they going to know?
I mean, that's a fair point.
This is New England, guys. Come on. Let's be honest.
They met with all 300 prospects. Right. They had them in a line waiting outside under the underpass to get into the Patriot Place.
Hitchhiking down Route 1. They're all hanging out at Chickie Flynn's.
Dude, I would be.
No, but I think, Andrew, you're right in saying that the Patriots have been able to find the next guy at corner. My only concern is they've been able to do that usually when there was already able to develop through that season. I still don't even really consider Malcolm Butler to have been like a great corner until probably the following year in 2015. And then you signed Stephon Gilmore in 2017, let Butler go, were able to develop Jackson that way. You do still have Jonathan Jones. And that's a name that I forget about very often because he was injured last year. And Jonathan Jones, I think, is another one of these guys where he was undrafted, right?
I believe so.
Yeah. So that may be the guy that they've already had and they've been able to kind of work in. I don't know if he's going to take that step into being like a number one corner, but I also don't know if Malcolm Butler is supposed to be their number one corner. I don't know if Jalen Mills is going to be their number one corner. I don't know if they know who their number one corner is. But if I had to put money on it, I would say it's probably not going to be a rookie.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about before we started recording, we talked about running backs a little bit. Like they've always had that passing down back a year too early that they grab them and they have their first year getting used to the thing. They like we just talked about with the cornerbacks. They did the same thing with James White. He was there when Shane Vereen was there. Shane Vereen was there when Kevin Faulk was there. It was that whole, it's been like a tradition there. So I wouldn't be surprised if they go after one of those guys in like the middle rounds as well. But I think that's part of the problem. Like cornerback, whether you want to call it like the fourth most important position in the football field, it's a position that really matters right now. And I don't think you have a competent number one guy on the roster, or even if you get a guy in this draft, like you said, I don't know if that guy is coming in and being the number one right away. Like to me, Mills played better than I expected last year as a number two cornerback.
And you throw him in a position that they were not planning on him to be in. He was more of a nickel down guy, and then Gilmore moves on.
And now you're also in the same boat with Jonathan Jones, who's been a nickel cornerback his whole career. If you're expecting him to step outside, who knows what that looks like. And well, I know we just talked about ACLs not really meaning anything, but he missed the entire season last year. I don't remember if his was an ACL though. He had a season-ending injury. He missed the entire year, I think.
Who again?
Patriots have
Jonathan Jones shoulder injury week 6, so he missed most of the year.
They have a lot of holes to fill, and I think the draft is obviously the best way to build for long-term success. Hopefully, they can figure something out. Gentlemen, we are at a little bit of a time crunch, so that's going to do it for episode 79 of Moving the Goalposts, Jacob Zboril 79.
It's retired for the Patriots. It's Jim Lee Hunt, retired.
Yep.
Cutter Crawford is wearing 79 right now.
Good one.
Did Lauzon wear 79?
No, he did not.
Real quick final blow, by the way. Finally watched The Batman.
What did you think?
You guys didn't see my tweet?
I did see the tweet, but the listeners didn't necessarily see the tweet.
True. Very true. Casting, good. Ideas and like what they were trying to do, good. Writing, awful. Did not like the dialogue, did not like the writing at all.
So when you say ideas, are you talking more like plot? And then when you say writing, you're talking more like execution then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. Yes. The plot of the story, I get what they were trying to do. And I like understood like what the storyline was. I think it could have just been executed better and portrayed a lot better. Like Riddler, I thought the Riddler was the best thing about the movie.
Paul Dano was fantastic.
Yeah. If we had more time, I was going to ask for your.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've done that one. That all comes from a South Park episode too.
The number one Paul Dano podcast.
No, it's not even, it's not the Paul Dano one. Who's the other guy from the movie?
Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah. What's his name in the movie though?
Oh God. I have no idea.
Abraham Lincoln.
Nope. Isn't it Daniel?
It might be. I don't know. I've only seen it once.
HW or G? What's his son's name? It's my son.
HW. It's
a big straw.
Bastard. Bastard in a basket.
Come on. You can do it.
My straw says your milkshake. Bastard in a basket. It's episode 79 of Moving the Goalposts.
That was a pedestrian effort. Yeah.
Episode 79 of Moving the Goalposts. Jacob Zboril, Jim Lee Hunt. Was that his name? Jim Lee Hunt?
Yep.
Yeah.
Hell of a name. Moving the goalposts. As always, we want to make sure that you folks are following along throughout the week. You can follow me on Twitter at NickMara94. I promise not to be so morbid this week. Masala, you can catch him at Mike_Masala. Producer extraordinaire Andrew Meehan can be followed at Meehan_83. Gentlemen, till next time.
Later, brother.
Peace.